Hello everyone, welcome to the 15th episode of the series of podcasts with IEEE Electron Devices Society Luminaries. As the world's largest professional organization, IEEE plays significant role to enhance the quality of our life. Electron Devices Society, or EDS, encompasses activities involving electron devices, the main enabler for today's digital world. I'm Mohammad Mustafa Hussein, a professor of electrical engineering and computer science of University of California, Berkeley. I play a variety of roles in different capacities within the Electron Devices Society of IEEE. In this series of podcasts, we will be interviewing those EDS members who have made remarkable impacts in our society through their innovations and dedication. Our guest today is someone who is one of the leading authorities of the current semiconductor industry spectrum. Kaiser Mistry is Vice President for Strategy and Technology for Business Enablement in the Technology Development Group at Intel. Most recently, he was co-director of the Logic Technology Development Group at Intel. Previously managed the development of Intel's 22-nanometer node logic technology, the world's first to feature 3D tri-gate transistors, and the development of Intel's 45-nanometer logic technology, the world's first to feature high-k plus metal gate transistors. Prior to joining Intel in 1998, Mistry was with the Semiconductor Technology Division at Digital Equipment Corporation, where he worked on the development of successive process technology generations from 1.5 micrometer CMOS through 1/4 micron CMOS. During this time, he researched hot carrier effects in MOSFETs extensively and published widely on this topic. Mistry is an IEEE fellow, has authored or co-authored more than 70 journal and conference papers, and holds 20 patents. In 2006, he was general chair of the IEEE Electron Devices Meeting, the industry's flagship conference on semiconductor devices. He graduated from the Indian Institute of Technology, Bombay, in 1984 with a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering. He graduated from the University of Southern California, Los Angeles, in 1986 with a master's degree in electrical engineering. He was a 2019 Distinguished Alumnus Award recipient of the Indian Institute of Technology, Bombay. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. As you know, it's the holidays right now, and so it's been relaxing to have a few days off from a busy work schedule. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Thank you. Thank you for your time. So my first question will go back to the very early on. So how was your childhood, your school life, you know, that kind of thing? And if there is anything that you have done in the school that you think like, I regret if I could redo it in a different way. Yeah. So we would like to know about your childhood, how you grew up.
Thanks for the question. I was born in India, and I had, I would say a very happy childhood. Both my parents were professors. My dad was a professor of engineering, and my mom was a professor of early childhood education. And so, you know, in one sense, it was a very kind of happy childhood because their students would always be coming through the house and talking about their dissertation topic or their classes or whatever it was. And so there was always interesting conversation going around in the house at all times. It was also interesting because there were professors that I spent my childhood both in India and the United States because they came to universities in the US. So I spent part of my childhood in India and then part of it in Illinois, part of it in South Carolina, and then back to India. So that was a very interesting cultural experience as well, The funny thing is, I think the biggest cultural change was probably going from Illinois to South Carolina. But very interesting childhood, a happy childhood. And I guess the only other thing I'd say is, you know, my interest in engineering and math started due to that childhood, because my dad would, you know, teach me, he loved math. And so he would teach me, you know, things before I learned them in college. And that really kind of spurred my interest in science and mathematics.
Fantastic. After that, I guess, after your school life, you attended IIT Bombay.
Yes.
And it's a funny school, tough school. I had the pleasure to visit in 2018, January. Anything you would like to share from your college life?
I think that IIT was in Bombay was a very formative experience for me, and my career, you know, is really due to that formative experience in two ways. One, just the people you met. As you said, it was very competitive, and so the people you met kind of spurred you on and made you want to do better because it was competitive in that sense. But more importantly, I think. There was a professor there named Professor Juzar Vasi, who had, in fact, when I was there, he had just finished his PhD at Johns Hopkins and returned to India to teach. And, you know, he was a very engaging teacher of electronics, of semiconductor physics. And I think that first class that I had with him on the basics of semiconductor physics is why I started, you know, the career path. That I started. So that was really a formative experience. And there were other professors there later on that also influenced me. But I think that first introduction to semiconductor physics when I was in Bombay probably set me on my career path that lasted, you know, many decades since then.
Right. So great. So that kind of like, you know, the in a sense that answers one of the questions that was we were preparing to ask you. I think, like, you know, that how you got inspired to pursue a career in electronics. And as you mentioned, that it started with your childhood, your dad, you know, he used to teach you things which you expect normally you should be expecting in college. And then Professor Juzar Vasi, I think he is still very much involved with our Electron Devices Society.
Yes,
so I know, yes. When you mention his name, it immediately strike me. I've seen his name and I've read his email. So that's great to actually start with. So, you know, my next question, I just wanted to actually let you know that I also started my graduate life like you in University of Southern California. So we are both Trojans.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's good to know. Yeah.
Okay. So can you please tell us about, you know, some of the stories of your graduate life?
Yeah. So, you know, after getting interested in semiconductor physics in Bombay in my undergraduate days, I went to the University of Southern California for graduate school. And there I was, again, I think very lucky to have two key influences from the professors there. One was my advisor, Professor John Choma, and the other one was a Professor Kurt Lehovec, who was at USC in those days. And he was, you know, such an illustrious person. He had grown up in Germany, immigrated to the United States, and, you know, was one of the inventors of the integrated circuit. He had one of the first patents on it, and he was on my thesis committee. So that was very inspiring to have somebody like that, you know, on your thesis committee. Also, the work that I did, you know, influenced the first kind of decade and a half of my career. My thesis project was on modeling hot carrier effects in SPICE. You know, that was a topic in the 1980s that was gaining a lot of interest, and I think it was one of the first you know, works on modeling hot carrier effects inside SPICE. And then I worked on hot carrier effects for quite a while after that. I think the experience of working with people that were heavily involved in the industry, as Professor Choma was, who'd played a leading role in just the whole development of the semiconductor industry, like Professor Lahovec. That was extremely lucky for me to have that experience.
Great. You know, Professor Choma was my academic advisor for year one. And he had his corner office. He used to teach the VLSI design. And it was always an overbooked class. And then he started teaching it with the distance learning, because USC was one of the pioneers in this area of distance learning, because they had many students who were attending from the industries. And then these overbooked students, they started taking his class outside of the classroom through the computer.
Yeah.
So he was that much famous and a very effective, a very charming personality, helped us a lot. But unfortunately, he passed away a couple of years back.
Right.
And Hot Electron, I think, one of our senior colleagues and one of the father figures in our field, Professor Chen Ming Hu, his work and SPICE, this is all going back to the area which eventually became the one of the major topics for the reliability, especially your work, which we'll be talking in depth on the high-k metal gate CMOS introduction, and where all these reliability issues, especially this kind of the Hot Electron and others, they were initially enigmatic, in 2006, 7, 8. The first time I saw you, that was in 2006 VLSI. Mm-hmm. You were the podium speaker in the afternoon session, the first talk after the plenary talk. You talked about the FinFET. Great. So let's talk about how did you start your career? What was your first job? What was your experience there?
Yeah, so after I finished my master's at USC, that was a time when most of the industry on the West Coast was suffering economically, but the East Coast was booming. Companies like IBM and Digital Equipment and others on the East Coast were booming and hiring. And so I ended up working for Digital Equipment on the East Coast. And again, I was extremely lucky. I had three really good managers or mentors when I joined DEC. One was Bill Bitterman, who was an IEEE fellow and a circuit design expert, who was actually chair of the VLSI Circuit Symposium a few years back. And then Don Nelson was another one who was from MIT and was a big influence. And then Bobby Heath was a third manager. She also was a big influence on me in my first few years. So I was extremely lucky throughout my career to have, professors and mentors who helped me see the light, as it were. But my first project, when I joined DEC, was to work on 2-micron CMOS. That's gives you an idea of how old I am. This was in 1986 or thereabouts. 2-micron CMOS was my first technology. Very quickly moved to 1.5-micron CMOS, which was the third CMOS generation at that point. And then worked on, and then at DEC, after those first couple of generations, I worked primarily on hot carrier effects for about 10 years, and then moved into more process integration type roles of the transistors, and then worked on SOI CMOS for a while before leaving DEC in 1998. But a dozen years that were very fruitful and very exciting years in the industry.
Fantastic. I wanted to actually bring a little bit of context here. So your career is about 30 to 35 years, let's say, professional
correct.
Career.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So when you mentioned 2-micron, right, you after the IEDM last week, we are hearing about the 2-nanometer. You are readying the technology to be introduced in 2025-26 timeframe. So which basically is telling us that in 30 to 35 years, you have brought 1,000 times scale device from 2 micron to 2 nanometer, right?
Three orders and of that magnitude. It's amazing.
Correct. Yeah. That actually tells us that where the CMOS electronics have gone, that in the given area, that Moore's law of, like, you know, they're having one device versus 1,000 devices today. And that has been possible because of people like you. And well, I think, I would, like, you know, that's the something.
Yeah, yeah, I would say it's been possible really because of thousands and thousands of people. Correct. You know, I think that's the story of the industry that I think is told the least, which is that engineering is about teamwork and teams of hundreds and thousands of people working together. It's not even a team of a dozen people. It's, you know, to do a modern process technology is a team of hundreds and even thousands of people working together to bring it to fruition. You know, these are extremely complex technologies and take many disciplines, from chemical engineering to electrical engineering to physics and mathematics you know, I think that part of the story, I think, is told the least, in fact.
Yeah, that is true, and it's kind of that we all the time we are using a smartphone or computing device or something like that. We're watching a television. Rarely we talk about that, what engineers do, right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. You have worked on many different projects, and, like, you know, that you have, like, you know, that there are things that which have made tremendous impact globally. Can you pick, like, you know, the one of the projects that you really enjoyed after, like, you know, that when it came to fusion, you became very happy? It made you really happy.
So it's hard to pick one. So I'm going to cheat a little bit and pick three, but I'll go through them and I'll show you why I picked three, because they each had a different element to them that made them special. The first was strained silicon. The second one was high-k metal gate, and the third one was FinFET. And each of them, I think each of them was a key project or key innovation that kept the semiconductor industry and Moore's Law going. But each one was very different in the way that it came about and the skills that it took to bring it to fruition. So that's why I wanted to talk a little bit about all three. Strained silicon was the first one. And that one was interesting because it came about by accident almost. Strained silicon had been talked about in the industry for a while, but the type of strained silicon that had been talked about was uniaxial strain. And the type that eventually ended up going into, biaxial strain. And the type that ended up going into manufacturing in the end was uniaxial strain, which we worked on at Intel. And the thing that's interesting, it happened by accident because we were playing with introducing silicon germanium into the source drain regions of MOS transistors. And we were doing that to improve the series resistance. There was a gentleman by the name of Anand Murthy who had really spearheaded this work at Intel, another USC graduate, by the way. He had spearheaded kind of this work in the research phase of doping boron-doped silicon germanium selective epitaxy to get higher active dopant concentrations in the source drain regions to improve our external. And then we measured these devices and we were all scratching our heads because the performance improvement was better than what we had expected. And I remember one engineer from our TCAD group came into one of the meetings one day and says, "You know what? I think this is the effect of strain." And he went through the whole explanation that he had, and that was kind of a eureka moment for us, because we all stood there and said, "Yes, of course, you know, you're right. This is not our external effect or a active dopant concentration effect. This is a stress or a strain effect." You know, at that point, we were very excited about the technology, and it took us 2 or 3 years to put it into production. But to me, that was the key moment of puzzling over data and then coming up with that eureka moment of understanding the data, which then lets you exploit it fully as you take it into manufacturing. Because once you understood it was strain, it wasn't the boron concentration in the film that was important. It was the germanium concentration that was introducing the strain that was important. And so we were able to optimize the device and extract performance out of it for many generations. The second one is high K metal gate. And that one was interesting because it was primarily a materials challenge, not so much a device physics challenge. It was a materials challenge. I think as you noted earlier, there were many reliability challenges with the material set, and managing oxygen vacancies inside the high K film was the key to making the devices reliable. But how to manage the oxygen vacancies was really almost a black art, a magic, tweaking things in the process, trying things till it worked. You knew what you were trying to do, but the actual recipe to do it was really trial and error. But it was really about material science and coming up with the right recipe to control the oxygen vacancies in the high K film and generate a reliable transistor. There was more to it, but I'm giving you the one highlight of high K metal gate. And then the last one was FinFETs. FinFETs, had originally been proposed way back in the early 1980s by, I think, a gentleman from Toshiba. A lot of work at UC Berkeley by Sujay King and Chenming Hu and others on it in the 1990s and 2000s. But taking it into production really was about chemical engineering, specifically about etch, because every single etch profile as you form the transistor, from the fin etch to the polysilicon etch to the spacer etch and down the road, each one of those etch profiles around this three-dimensional shape had to be tailored to be a precise geometry in order for it to be manufacturable at high yields. And so this is why I picked all three, because each one had a very different challenge. And this goes back to the theme we were talking about earlier, where technology is about teamwork and bringing together the skills of many different types of science and engineering.
Yeah, these are the those days I still remember, that when I started doing my PhD. So that was on high K metal gate, gate first integration. And you guys brought the gate last.
Yes.
And then reminding of you remember that PowerPoint slide where we used to show that, there were only 13 materials that we used from the chemical periodic table.
Right,
but
right.
When the high K metal gate came, that it was exploded up to 82. And there were, it is said, I'm not sure that whether this is true or not completely, that approximately 850 different combinations of high K metal gate were tried.
Yeah.
Because it was all about thermal stability, work function, Fermi level pinning, the reliability issue, then how to really integrate different kind of devices, right? It was a unique challenge. And then the integration, in a sense, nightmare came with the three-dimensional the devices with the non-planar architecture, all those etches, and then after the etching, whether they are smooth or not, because they were also being reflected through the mobility of the channels that we had. 110 was opening up for us, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It was a fantastic time, I would say, that I still remember. You are absolutely right. The thousands of people in different universities, institutions, industries, they were working on then all the I would say that the conferences were just filled up with who has what today, who is going to show what, either it's going to be FUSI, it's going to be gate last, or it's going to be gate first.
Yes.
It so, was
both strained silicon and high K metal gate had that aspect to it, because there were competing approaches to taking it to manufacturing. For strained silicon, there was uniaxial and biaxial strain techniques. And for high K metal gate, as you mentioned, there was gate first, gate last, FUSI, many alternate ways to get it to manufacturing. But in the end, the best method won, and everybody else followed it. So it's very interesting to see how you know, you have all these ideas that percolate and then one of them works and then the whole industry moves on.
Yeah, and we could actually, it's really admirable because those who have worked with, like, you know, the time pressure and all these kind of things, that to do one, we didn't actually give up the others, you know, that's what makes it really additive, in the sense that the semiconductor technology has been enriched because we never gave up on something.
It's a sequence of innovation stack, one on top of the other.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Okay. This is a question. I'm like, you know, that I although it's listed, but I'm not sure that, like, you know, that I should be asking, but I think it's going to reaffirm your own passion for electron devices. That, let's say you go back maybe 40 years or 35, 30 years, that would you have chosen electron devices as your profession, the thematic, like, you know, that this was or something else?
Yes, you know, if I had my, you know, if I was starting my career again, I definitely would choose engineering. I don't think there's any question about that, because of, you know, that's where my passion was. I think, you know, one of my uncles at one point when I was in high school tried to convince me to go into medicine, and I said, no, you know, I want to do engineering. But doing electron devices was, you know, the luck of the advisors that I had, and I think I was extremely lucky to have those advisors, and so I would definitely choose engineering and hope that I had the good luck to have those good advisors again to choose electron devices.
Right. Okay, so I think, like, you know, that right now I would like to switch to a little bit lighthearted portion. Mm-hmm. Where I will be asking you some questions where we prefer that you can answer in a word. If not, like, you know, then you can elaborate, because we would like to hear from you. This is a very popular portion, especially with our young viewers. And whenever you're ready, this is a rapid fire round.
Go right ahead.
Okay. What are your hobbies?
Two main hobbies: road cycling. I like to road cycle, and reading. Those are my two main hobbies.
Great. Movies or music? Which one you enjoy more?
Music, definitely. I enjoy music a lot.
Okay. What genre of music you like the most?
I listen to three genres regularly: classical, jazz, and rock. And you know, just this morning I was listening to Beethoven. Yesterday I was listening to a rock band called Vampire Weekend, and also a jazz singer named Billie Holiday. So all three of those genres I listen to a lot.
Very good. What book you are reading now?
I always read two or three books at a time. So right now I'm reading two books. One is a book by P.G. Wodehouse, the British humorist, called Joy in the Morning. And the other one is a book by James Thurber called The White Deer. It's kind of a fairy tale story that, you know, it's a holiday season. So it's a book for a fantasy story like that.
Okay, very good. What is your favorite cuisine?
I like to cook Indian food, but my favorite food to eat is probably Ethiopian food.
Okay. Yeah, they have some fantastic food. Yeah, there are a couple of restaurants in Berkeley area.
Yeah.
We often... Yeah, any university town has always different kind of flavors. Of them, yes.
But my favorite one is in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Okay. Obviously, you bike, but still, you know, any sports you enjoy except biking?
Well, to take part in biking, but to watch football or soccer. I went to Brazil a few years ago to watch the World Cup, so I really enjoy watching football or soccer.
Okay. I don't know which team you supported or you support, but that was a very sad moment for Brazil. But they very graciously actually accepted that kind of a little bit, like, you know, that I would say a little bit stretched defeat by Germany, right? 7-1.
Yes. I was staying with Brazilian friends, so they were very sad. Yes,
but they graciously accepted that defeat, actually. Yeah. What is your favorite travel spot?
I like to travel a lot. I've been to many places in the world, but the one place that I really, really want to go to next, once COVID is over and we can travel again, is New Zealand. I've never been, and I really want to go. So that's my next stop in my world travels.
Yeah, I think that you are going to really enjoy the land of the hobbits, and it's so green and luscious green, and like in the blue everywhere.
Yeah.
it's fantastic. Okay, Kaizad, I think we are in the last part of our conversation. And so this is a bit of like philosophical. What is your thought about electronics in the future?
So future of electronics, I would say two things. One, I think the demand for electronics is insatiable. We have had, Moore's Law for over 50 years now, and compute is everywhere. We all have our cell phones and laptops and you know, what have you. But I think the demand for electronics is insatiable. Data is growing at a tremendous rate. So if engineers can continue to innovate, the market to sell electronics will still be there. Now, so the question is, will engineers continue to be able to innovate? And I would say yes. And this is the second part of my answer, which is it's going to be the same and it's going to be different. I think on the one hand, traditional Moore's Law scaling is going to continue, at least for the next decade, if not longer. You can see gate-all-around transistors and vertical transistor stacking and other options already at a fairly advanced stage of research to carry us for the next decade or more. But I think the second element, which is heterogeneous integration, is really going to be the key to the future of electronics over the next decade or two, where you can take chips that are built in a process optimized for their specific function, and then hook them together in a 3D package or a 2.5D package, multiple chips to have the best realization of each of those functions in a technology that's optimized for that function. And then connect them together with very high speed connections inside these heterogeneous packages. So, I think the death of Moore's Law has been called many times, and I think it's been wrong every time, and it's wrong again this time. It will be, the same, and it will be different. But the key to Moore's Law has always been innovation and new ideas. And I don't think there's any dearth of smart engineers in colleges and high schools and even kindergarten future engineers that are going to come forth and carry the torch and come up with new ideas. And so innovation will continue.
Right. I think that's why currently there is this semiconductor manufacturing overall semiconductor technology workforce development is a key challenge that I think that we are taking them on unitedly, and we should be able to address them in the sense of keeping the momentum on. And every time I hear about this Moore's Law is dying or something like that, one thing I keep saying, students, the group members and colleagues, they come and they ask this question sometimes, and then I keep saying that it's always feel very good to win when my competitors are at their peak, rather than actually suggesting that they're going to die and then I win. Yes. It doesn't really make sense. It really doesn't make sense. Anyway, my next question is, is there anything that strikes your mind today that which could have been better? Anything?
I'm going to answer slight twist on that question. I think that one of the key challenges in the world today is global warming. As a international or global challenge. And I think that science and engineering can play a much bigger role in addressing that problem than it has so far. And to people that worry about those challenges that the globe faces, you know, my answer is the answer lies in science and engineering, in particular, even electronics, because solar has to be a big part of the solution, and energy management systems have to be a big part of the solution. And so both of those are going to need electronics in one way, shape, or form, or the other. And so I think that that's an area where, both the needs of the world and the capabilities of science and engineering have more opportunity, I think, to do better than we have so far.
Exactly. Both of them, they depend on a reliable semiconductor.
Yes.
Whether that's energy harvesting, whether that's energy storage eventually, as well as the energy management. I think the way that the usage of electronics has gone up, at the same time, it means that, it requires energy. So there is power consumption. And we have to address those. And I think that's part of this overall strategy of having the right energy balance that is sustainable for us and for our future generation. The next question is, as you have seen over, I would say, in the last 10 years, the way that the electronics have penetrated in different application areas, which were never envisioned of in a sense, right? There was a time many years back that television was this bulky. Nowadays, these are so slim, and then they're becoming bendable. That's one example. We are seeing more and more automated vehicles, drones, self-driven car. And obviously, as your uncle mentioned, that he encouraged you to be a doctor. But, the things that we work on, electronics, they are going to be utilized in many, many different kind of wearable, implantable, and biomedical devices, which are going to be the tools and methods for our, the physician community, the medical purposes. So is there any specific application that you would like to see come to fruition in near future or in future?
Well, I already talked about the example of global warming and where I see a lot of applications for science and engineering. Correct. In the future. But there's one other one that I'd like to point out, which is, really become apparent in these last 2.5 years with COVID, which is remote work. And I think that, the fact that we were able to survive COVID and, the global economy didn't come to a stop is because of the fact that we have an electronics industry and all these devices that enable us to stay connected, that have enabled us to stay connected and continue to work and collaborate across the world. But I think it's still nascent. I think the opportunity for electronics to change the way people work and interact and not have to commute to work every day and yet collaborate more effectively, I think we've just touched the leading edge of that wave, and I think that's a wave that partly inspired by everyone's experience of these COVID years is going to shape the way we all work over the next many decades.
Yeah, and I think that this has socioeconomic impact definitely. And obviously now I think we have understood the challenges as well as the opportunities, and next we should be seeing more and more innovation in these areas, at least in the next 10 years to actually see something which is really, really, one thing I keep saying that just build one fantastic electronic hardware, which is going to keep the momentum for next 15 years. It's sort of like, because of the touchscreen phone, today we have Uber, Lyft, Instacart, the Netflix, everything that has become, all has come to our hand, right?
Yes.
But if we did not have that hardware product, nothing would have been possible.
Correct.
So it's exactly the same way. I'm pretty sure that there will be something which is, and I maybe not one, there will be multiple different things that's going to
and as you say, life. You know, the first handheld phone like that was not new in terms of the components of the technology. The display screen existed, the processors existed, the cell phone technology existed. It was the social engineering of putting together a product that people wanted to use that was the key innovation. And so, you know, this is the other part of science and engineering, is that in the end you want a product that helps society, enriches society. The laptop did that, the PC did that, the smartphone did that, and there will be more such products in the future that will shape the way we live and we work.
Exactly. Okay, so the formal last question, that is your advice to the next generation.
So three parts to the advice. First, and none of this is a surprise because I've hinted at all of this already. First, you know, the problems of the world that the world faces, such as global warming and other problems that the world faces, the answers lie in science and engineering. You cannot solve problems like that and have society be functional, economies be functional, without solving them through science and engineering. That's the first comment. The second one is, science and engineering is fun. Inventing things is fun. Hard work, in fact, is fun when you see the results of that hard work being used by people all around the world. And the third part is, you know, any kind of science and engineering is really the collaboration of thousands of people across different disciplines. And so teamwork, learning to work with other people with different mindsets, different skills, different social backgrounds from all around the world. That's part of the joy as well as the success, I would say, of engineering and science, is bringing all these people together to solve problems.
Correct. Thank you so much, Kaizad. Before we wrap up, I think we are heading toward the new year, so advance Happy New Year.
Yes, Happy New Year to you as well.
To you and to your beloved ones. Anything, any that we did not ask you, but you wanted to actually talk about?
No, I think you asked very good questions, a comprehensive set of questions. So thank you very much. And it was really a pleasure chatting with you today.
Thank you for attending this IEEE EDS-sponsored podcast. To listen to other EDS podcasts, as well as benefits and resources EDS offers, please go to the website eds.ieee.org. Thank you for listening.